The hinge of victory in the West would be Vicksburg, and as the Cobbs moved toward it, always striving to join up with their parent regiment already in position at Vicksburg, they could hear their soldiers grousing, "We still ain't got no horses, and that's a disgrace, and we still ain't got enough rifles, and that's a disaster, and we're being led by a Northerner, and that's disgusting." Yes, the army which was to defend Vicksburg was commanded by a Philadelphia Quaker, who, despite his pacifist religion, had attended West Point, where he had acquired a fine reputation. Marrying a Southern belle from Virginia, he considered himself a resident of his bride's family plantation, where he became more Southern than Jefferson Davis. A man of credibility and power, he had not wavered when the great decision of North or South confronted him. He chose the South of his wife's proud family, and quickly established himself as one of the abler Confederate generals. Now, General John C. Pemberton had a command on which the safety of the South depended, and his men, who had been born in the South, did not approve. "With all the superb soldiers we have," Reuben growled, "why do we have to rely on a Northerner of doubtful loyalty? If Vicksburg falls, the Mississippi falls, and if that river goes, the Confederacy is divided, and Texas could fall." He lowered his voice. "And if Texas falls, the world falls." He was also having trouble with a new officer assigned to his unit, Captain Otto McNabb, who had reported to the bivouac area with guns and pistols sticking out in all directions. Some men in Cobb's force had Enfields of powerful range. Some had the old Sharps that could knock down a house, and a few had old frontier single-shot rifles which their grandfathers had used against Indians. But there were nearly 24 in the company who had no armament at all, and Major Cobb fumed about this, dispatching numerous letters to Austin begging for guns. None were available, he was told. And so he moved among his men, trying to find any soldier who had more than one. And of course he came upon Captain McNabb, who had an arsenal. But when he tried to pry guns loose from him, he ran into real trouble. "I don't give up my guns to anybody." "If I give you an order..." Cobb suddenly remembered from McNabb's enlistment papers that he had been a ranger, and Somerset had warned, "Reuben, never tangle with a ranger. My brother Percifer had rangers in his command, and he said they were an army of their own, a law to themselves." "They're in my command now," Major Cobb had replied, "and McNabb will do what I say." "Don't bet on that," Set had said. And now, when his cousin tried to take one of McNabb's guns, the red-headed warrior met real opposition. "Isn't it reasonable," Cobb began, "that if you have two rifles and the next man has none..." "I know how to use a rifle. Maybe he don't." There might have been an ugly scene had not Somerset intervened. "Aren't you the McNabb who served in Mexico with my brother?" "Colonel Percifer Cobb?" McNabb asked. And when Set nodded, McNabb said, "He knew how to fight. I hope he's on our side now." And Cobb replied, "No, he's tending our family plantation in Carolina." A month before, that statement would have been correct, for Percifer Cobb, like many of the great plantation managers throughout the South, had been asked to stay at home, producing stuffs required for the war effort. But as the fortunes of battle began slowly to turn against the South, men like him had literally forced their way to the colors, sometimes riding far distances to enlist. And as a former West Point man, his services were welcomed. So now three Cobbs of the same generation were in uniform. Colonel Percifer, in Northern Virginia, Major Reuben, in charge of replacement troops for the 2nd Texans, and Captain Somerset. There were also five Cobbs' sons from the three families, while at the various plantations, the wives of the absent officers endeavored to hold the farms and mills together. Tessa May at Edisto, Millicent at Lakeview, and Petty Prue at the newly christened Lammermoor. The Cobbs were at war. Major Cobb wisely withdrew his attempt at forcing McNabb to surrender one of his guns, but he was gratified when his tough little officer came into camp one day with 7 rifles of varied merit, which he had scrounged from surrounding farms. "They'll all fire," he told Cobb. "Not saying how straight, but if you get close enough, that don't matter." When the contingent crossed over to the east bank of the Mississippi, Major Cobb saw that his Texans would have to fight their way into Vicksburg, for a strong Union detachment was dug in between them and the town. He could have been forgiven had he turned back, but this never occurred to him. Acting as his own scout and probing forward, he identified the difficulties and gathered his men. "If we make a hurried swing to the east, we can circumvent the northern troops, then dash back and into Vicksburg." "What protects our left flank if they hear us and attack?" McNabb asked. And Cobb said, "You do." "Give me a couple of dozen good shots and we'll hold them off." Through the dark night, Otto coached his team, and at 2 he said, "Catch some sleep." But he continued to prowl the terrain over which they would fight. Just before dawn, a Galveston volunteer asked, "If we do get into Vicksburg, can we hold it with a general like Pemberton in charge?" And Otto gave him a promise solemnly, as if taking a sacred oath. "When we set up our lines at Vicksburg, hell itself won't budge us." This reckless promise did not apply to the battle next morning at Big Black River, for Grant was moving with such incredible swiftness that he overtook the Confederates before dawn and launched such a powerful attack that he drove them right across the deep ravines and back to the gates of Vicksburg. In previous battles and skirmishes, Captain McNabb, now a man of 41 and extremely battle-wise, had not, in even the slightest way, tried to avoid combat. That would be unthinkable. But he had thoughtfully picked those spots and developing situations at which he could do the most good. However, this battle degenerated into such a hideous mess that plans and prudence alike were swept aside, and he found himself in such a general melee of gray and blue that in desperation he lashed out like a wild man, casting aside his rifles and firing his Colts with such abandon that he himself drove back almost a squad of Yankees. In those moments he was not a soldier, he was an incarnation of battle, and when, because of their tremendous superiority, the northern troops began to sweep the banks of a little stream which the Texans were struggling to cross, he shouted to his men, "Don't let it happen." When by force of iron-like character he had driven away the northerners so that his troops could complete their escape, he contemptuously remained behind, searching the field the Yankees had just deserted, even though their sharpshooters still commanded it. "McNabb," Major Cobb shouted from a distance, "what in hell are you doing?" "Looking for my guns?" And when he saw where he had discarded his rifles during the chase, he calmly stooped down, retrieved them, and headed into Vicksburg. On the 19th of May, General Grant brought 35,000 Union soldiers before the 9-mile-long defenses of Vicksburg. There, he faced 13,000 Confederate troops well dug in, with 7,000 in reserve. The northern battle plan was straightforward. Smash through the defenses, take the town, and deny the Mississippi River to the Confederates. When that happens, Texas will be cut off from the Confederacy and will wither on the vine. So every Texan fighting at Vicksburg knew that he was really fighting to defend his home state. As soon as his massive army was in position, Grant ordered a probe of the Confederate lines, and, to his surprise, it was thrown back. For the next 2 days, he prepared the most intense artillery bombardment seen in the war so far. It would utilize every piece of ordnance, hundreds of heavy cannon, and it would start at 6 in the morning. On the night of the 21st, he assembled his commanders and issued an order which demonstrated the mechanical strength he proposed to throw against the Southerners. "Set your watches. At 10 sharp, the artillery barrage will cease, and your men will leave their positions, attack up that hill, and overwhelm the enemy." For the first time in world history, all units along a vast front would set forth at the same moment. "There's bound to be some ugly skirmishing," an Illinois captain warned his troops, "but before noon we should have their lines in our hands. Then an easy march into Vicksburg." That last night, as the two armies slept fitfully, General Grant's order of battle was awesome, studded as it was with distinguished names: the 118th Illinois Infantry, the 29th Wisconsin Infantry, the 25th Iowa, the 4th West Virginia, the 5th Minnesota, and then two names that symbolized the fraternal agony of this war: the 7th Missouri, the 22nd Kentucky. Their brothers would be fighting the next day as Confederates, the 1st Missouri, the 8th Kentucky. To reach the Confederate lines, the Union soldiers had to sweep down into a pronounced valley, then climb a steep hill, and charge into the teeth of cleverly disposed fortifications. These were of three types: the redoubt, a large square earthwork easy to hold if there were enough men; the redan, a triangular projection out from the line to permit concentration of fire upon an attacker; and the smallest of the three, the lunette, a crescent-shaped earthwork, compact, with steeply sloping sides, and not easy to capture. Tough Louisiana swamp fighters occupied the major redan. Detachments from various parts of the South held the railroad redoubt, and the 2nd Texas Sharpshooters, a name recently bestowed because of their great accuracy with rifles, held the key spot in the line, a lunette guarding the main road back to town. Here, Major Cobb's replacement detachment finally joined up with their fellow Texans. During the furious cannonading on the morning of the 22nd of May, Cobb's men took what shelter they could, doing their best to survive until the attack began. "Why can't our side fire back?" a frightened boy of 17 asked, and Cobb said bluntly, "Because they have the cannon, and we don't." At 10 minutes to 10, all the Yankee batteries fired as rapidly as they could in order to provide their troops with as much last-minute cover as possible. At 10 o'clock, the fiery monsters fell silent, and in that first awful hush, bugles began to sound, first one and then another, echoing back and forth until the valleys facing the redoubts, the redans, and the lunettes reverberated with their clear and stirring sounds. Then came the infantry attack, down slight inclines at first, then across level ground, then straight up the steep flanks protecting the Confederate line. It required about 18 minutes for the 1,000 or more blue-clad troops assigned to take the Texas lunette to advance across the open land. And to some who watched the solemn approach from inside the fortification, it seemed as if the Northerners would never reach their goal, as if they would march forever, like dream figures across a timeless landscape. But quickly enough for both attacker and defender, the ominous blue line reached the steep flanks, scrambled up, and broke into the lunette, where a wild, confused struggle took place. With rifles, pistols, revolvers, even with bayonets and clubs, the Texas defenders threw back the Union attackers, South and North falling upon each other in bloody fury. The struggle went on for an incredible number of hours, with the dogged Texans repelling first one assault, then another, then countless others. Each time the Yankees surged forward up those steep final flanks, they did reach the top, and they did kill defenders, and always they seemed to have victory just within their grasp. "Follow me," shouted a lieutenant, waving his blue cap, until a Texas rifle ended his charge and his cry and his life. Otto McNabb kept his men from panic by constantly moving among them with gestures of encouragement. He used few words, and by leaping into the breach whenever a perilous weakness showed. Indeed, he stifled so many nearly fatal assaults that his survival was a miracle. Well into the afternoon, the Yankee assault on the lunette halted, to enable the batteries encased in the hills behind to throw down a savage curtain of fire, hoping thus to dislodge the weakened Texans. But when the cannonade stopped and the men in blue resumed their charge, the indomitable 2nd Texas repelled them yet again. The slaughter now became obscene, a grotesque expenditure of life, gray and blue, on the sloping edges of a lunette which could never quite be taken. Loss came closest at about 2:30, when a determined captain from Illinois led a charge with such bravery that he carried right into the lunette, with some 9 or 10 Yankees following, and had even a dozen more succeeded in joining him, and they tried desperately, the Texans would have been subdued, and Grant would have had the one foothold he needed to break the line. But at this moment, while McNabb was engaged with a mighty assault on his little sector, and Reuben Cobb was involved on his, Captain Somerset Cobb, with a courage he had not known he possessed, leaped directly at the Illinois leader, and drove a sword clear through his body. The man staggered forward, thinking victory still within his grasp. clutched at the air, and fell back, and the crucial charge faded. But now a young boy, not over 15, ran screaming into the Lunette from the southern stretch of the trench line. Railroad redoubts fallen. And when the Texans looked across the short distance to the big fort on their right, they saw that the messenger was correct. This redoubt, big and loosely constructed, was protected by a much less severe slope than the Texas Lunette, and against it the Yankees were having real success. Some were already in the fort, and others seemed about to break through. If Northern guns occupied the redoubt, the Texas Lunette was doomed. It took Major Cobb and Captain McNabb about 5 seconds to see and appreciate the peril in which the Confederate line stood, and without consultation, these two, plus some 50 of their men, ran like dodging, frightened, low-clinging deer across the open space between the two projections. They arrived just in time to meet the day's most furious battle, blue and gray in one tremendous tangle, with the former on the knife edge of victory. "Stop them!" Major Cobb shouted to the men following him. "In there!" McNabb never uttered cries in battle. He was always too busy managing his deadly guns. But this time the peril was so great that even he shouted, "Here!" He and some 15 others leaped directly into the foremost Yankee guns. And although several of his men went down in the dreadful fusillade, their sheer weight carried them forward. But as soon as this breach was stabilized, Otto saw that Federal troops were streaming in through a larger break farther on. "Cobb," he shouted. And the red-haired major, his cap lost in the battle, swung about to face some new enemy when a musket discharge caught him full in the face, blowing his head apart. "Men," McNabb cried, and his high voice was so compelling, so unique among the battle sounds, that his men formed behind him, and in a surge of slashing and firing, repelled the attackers from the wavering line. Grant had been denied his victory. The Confederate lines had held firm all the way from the railroad redoubt at the south, which Major Cobb and Captain McNabb had saved at the last moment, to the bloodied stockade redan at the north. Now the long, cruel siege would begin. The terror of Vicksburg lay not in those wild charges of that first day, for then men from both sides fought in white heat, and death came so explosively, so suddenly, that there was no awareness that it had struck until a companion fell silent amid the roar. The real terror began on that night of the 22nd of May, because in the open space between the two battle lines lay several thousand Union wounded, and for reasons which have never been explained, General Grant decided to leave them there rather than allow the customary battle truce for the removal of the dead and the rescue of the wounded. Perhaps he thought that on the next day the Confederates would be so exhausted that his men could gain an easy triumph, and he did not want to give the enemy any respite. At any rate, he left his dying exposed to the cold night air. But what was worse, he left them there all during the next day, that fiercely hot May morning, that blazing May afternoon. Now some of the men dying on the dusty field were so close to the Lunette that the Texans could hear them pleading for water, and others were so near the Federal lines that Union men could hear their companions' pleas. But all across the vast battlefield the order stood, no truce. Night brought no release, for now the battle wounds, some of them 40 hours old, had grown gangrenous from the day's prolonged heat, and both the pain and the smell were unbearable. It was unspeakable, the agony that came as a result of this hideous decision not to clear the battlefield. "If I ever see Grant," a Texan shouted into the night, hoping that some Northern soldier would hear, "I'll shoot his bloody eyes out." At about 2 in the morning, Otto McNabb, who had seen a great deal of war and who knew how men should die, could stand no more. Leaving the Lunette, he went out among the dying. And when he found a Northern soldier in the last shrieking pain of gangrenous agony, he shot him. And in doing this, he attracted the attention of a Missouri man who was doing the same from his lines. Meeting in the dark shadows, neither soldier entertained even the most fleeting idea of shooting the other. That you, Reb?
Yank. What unit?
Texas. You?
Missouri.
We have Missouri men on our side. Good fighters. You know a sergeant named O'Callahan?
I don't know many.
Should you come upon him? The man was a schoolteacher. I'll tell him. My brother. Good kid. When Otto crept back to the lines, he went to all parts of the Lunette, and even back to the railroad redoubt, shaking men awake and asking if they'd seen a Missouri man named O'Callahan. On the morning of the 24th of May, in response to a plea from the Confederates, General Grant relaxed his inhumane order, a truce was agreed upon, and men from each side moved out upon the battlefield to look at the bodies of those who might have been saved had it come earlier. When the truce ended, the soldiers returned to their respective lines. The war resumed, with General Grant bitterly acknowledging that he was not going to capture Vicksburg by frontal assault. He would have to do so by siege, which he promptly initiated. Not a man, not a scrap of food, not a horse would move in or out, and the last bastion on the Mississippi would fall. But during the truce, soldiers from each side had met with their opponents, and a respect had developed, so that invariably in the quiet evenings the men began to fraternize and sing. The northern troops refrained from insulting their friends with the battle hymn, while the southerners rarely sang Dixie. Always in the course of the night, some group of southerners would begin the song they loved so deeply, and northerners would fall silent as the winsome harmony began. We loved each other then, Lorena, more than we ever dared to tell. And what we might have been, Lorena, had but our lovings prospered well. The song had a wonderfully rich sentiment, which sounded elegant in the stillness, and some from the north almost chuckled at it. But toward the end, even the most indifferent hushed when a strong, high tenor sang solo of death and life hereafter. There is a future, O thank God, of life this is so small a part. 'Tis dust to dust beneath the sod, but there, up there, 'tis heart to heart. Otto did not care for such songs, too much about death, but he did stop his battlefield wandering when northern troops sang one song that he had not known before. Ora Lee spoke of love as he recalled it, and sometimes when the singing ended, he found himself humming the tune to himself or mumbling the words. Ora Lee, Ora Lee, maid with golden hair, sunshine came along with thee, and swallows in the air. He thought of Franziska in those terms. He could see her bringing sunshine, and it was not preposterous to think of her as attended by swallows. In the following weeks, when starvation clamped its iron claws about the innards of the Texans, both Somerset Cobb and Otto McNabb took short, dreamlike excursions. Cobb into Vicksburg to meet with the Peel sisters he had stayed with while on his way to Texas in 1850. McNabb out into the battlefield at night to compare situations with O'Callahan of Missouri. The Peel sisters still had their house at the north end of Cherry Street, but since it was exposed to artillery fire from Federal warships in the Mississippi below, they lived, like so many others, in hillside caves. Lucky for them, the caves were available, for their house had already taken two hits, and had they been sleeping upstairs, they would probably have been killed. Like all the citizens of Vicksburg, the Peels had started out confident that Grant would be forced to withdraw. But as the foodless weeks passed, they began to see the inevitability of defeat. However, they would not speak of it. "You mean that fine young man who traveled with you from Carolina?"
"From Georgia, ma'am, my cousin."
"And he was killed on the first day?"
"Most gallantly."
"I remember his reading to us from Ivanhoe."
"He loved Scott. We named our Texas plantation Lammermoor."
"That's nice. That's very nice."
"Miss Emma, I wish to God we had food in the lines to share with you."
"No, Major, we wish we had food for you."
Miss Etta May said, "Is my sister right? You're a major now?" Before he could answer, the cave in which they were meeting was shaken by a violent attack of shellfire from the warships, and as soon as it stopped, a cluster of explosions from the batteries inland rocked the area. "They hold us in a crossfire," Miss Emma said. "It's murderous. 3 slaves on this street killed this week." The Peel sisters did not leave their cave except for sunlight on quiet days, and even then they never knew when a stray shell from the river or from the battle line might kill them and everyone else in sight. They were wraith-like, each weighing less than 100 pounds. But they maintained high spirits in order to encourage the soldiers who stopped by to see them. On the evening of July 1st, Otto McNab, suffering from the acute hunger which had attacked him viciously that day, wandered through the battlefield during the customary informal truce. And when he saw how close to the Texan lunette the Yankee sappers had brought their trenches, he gasped. Starting to pace off the tiny distance that would separate the 2 lines when battle resumed next day, he was interrupted by a voice he was delighted to hear. It was O'Callaghan. "Distance is 7 feet, Reb. You could spit into our lunette. Spittin' even a foot with you Rebs is difficult." The 2 men sat side by side on the edge of the fatal trench, and each knew that when it progressed a few feet farther, the Texas position could be blown to hell with dynamite charges. "You about starved out, Reb?" "Well, now..." The posturing was ended. McNab could joke about death and the Union failure to consolidate, but he could no longer joke about starvation. "One hell of a way to end the battle. Only way you left us, you stubborn bastards." As they parted for the last time, the Union man looked about swiftly, then moved toward McNab. "I could be shot. If they catch you, say you stole it." And into Otto's pocket he stuffed 2 pieces of bread and a chunk of Wisconsin cheese. Back in the lunette, McNab knew that as a human being, and especially as an officer, he ought to share his unexpected treasure with his men. But this he could not do. Surreptitiously he gnawed at a tiny piece of the cheese, and he believed that he had never tasted anything so delicious in his life. He could feel the nourishment racing through his body, as if one organ were shouting to another, "Food at last! Sweet Jesus, food at last!" He had slowly, secretly consumed 1 of the pieces of bread and much of the cheese when an orderly passed by. "Colonel wants to see you." When he reported, his stomach reveling in the food it had found, the colonel, a medical doctor from Connecticut and a Yale graduate, but now the defender of a lunette on the Mississippi, said, "I suppose you've heard about Major Cobb." "What?" "Visiting his 2 old ladies. Smuggling them food, I suppose. Came out of their cave just in time to meet a Union shell head-on." "Dead?" "Left arm blown off. The slave who ran out here said they thought he bled to death." "May I go in?" "You're needed here. You're Major McNab now, and your job is to hold off those sappers at the foot of our lunette." "Yes, sir." All day on the 2nd of July, McNab devised tricks for rolling giant fused bombs down into the northern trench only a few feet away. And once, when he was successful, blowing up an entire length of the trench and all its occupants, his men crowded around to congratulate him. That was the last major event at the Texas lunette. For that night, the soldiers of each side, without orders from General Grant or anyone else, quietly decided that this part of the war was over. Pemberton sent Grant a letter, a northerner said. "I spoke with the orderly." "I think Pemberton wants to surrender right now," a rebel reported. "But Grant, he'll want it for a big show on the 4th of July. For us, it ends tonight." Otto searched for O'Callaghan, but no one had seen him. So, still a professional, he walked to the daring sap which had carried the Union lines so close to his. 6 more days," he told a northern soldier. "You'd have made it." "We'd have made it today, but some clever greatcoat dropped a tornado on us." "You know a man named O'Callaghan?" "One of your rolling bombs got him this afternoon." "Dead?" probably alive. I saw them drag him away. In the distance, there was singing. Ora Lee from the Northerners, and then, as an act of final Confederate defiance, the Bonnie Blue Flag, whispered at first by the defeated Southerners, and then bellowed, with many Northerners joining in. We are a band of brothers, and native to the soil, fighting for the property we won with honest toil. Along the Vicksburg line that night there was not one Negro in uniform on either side. The fight had been about him, but never by him. One Confederate trooper, who operated a cotton gin at Nacogdoches, summarized Texan thinking. No niggers ever been born could handle a gun. They'd be useless. The month of July 1863 was one of overwhelming sorrow at the Jefferson Plantation, for tragedy seemed to strike the Cobbs from all sides. Petty Prue, in the big house at Lammermoor, knew that her husband was dead at Vicksburg, and her older son at Gettysburg. Her younger boy was fighting somewhere in Virginia. On some hot mornings, she doubted that she could climb out of bed, so oppressive was the day, so oppressive was her life. But she had a plantation to run, some 90 slaves to keep busy, and cotton to be handled for the Confederacy. So, at dawn each day, she was up and working just as if her husband were absent for a few weeks and the crop promised to some factor in New Orleans. What perplexed her, as the cotton matured in its bolls and the picking began, was how to handle the crop when it had been harvested, for the Yankee blockade of all the seaports prevented open shipments of fiber to Liverpool. Cotton was being grown, but it was not being moved, and there was always the danger that if the bales accumulated at a spot like Jefferson, so near the border, Union forces might rush in and burn them, and the plantations, and set free the slaves. Now, with the entire Mississippi River in Union hands, the possibility of such a foray grew, and a lone woman like Petty Prue, somewhat flighty in peacetime, faced problems she could scarcely solve. The dismal news affected Millicent, too, for in mid-July word was received via the telegraph to New Orleans that Colonel Persifer Cobb of Edisto, that erect, formal gentleman with his West Point education, had died at Gettysburg. The telegram had ended. Son John also died. Will you all come back and supervise plantation? Tessa May. Millicent, weakened by the privations of war, was incapable of grappling with the changes contained in this message. Vaguely, she remembered that it had been sweet-talking Tessa May who had encouraged the expulsion of the Somerset Cobbs from Edisto, and Millicent could not imagine any terms on which they might consent to return. But such selfish considerations vanished when she thought of Tessa May's double bereavement and of how distraught she must be trying to manage that vast plantation. During the better part of a morning, she wept for the lone widow on Edisto and for all the other widows this war was making. This led her to thoughts about herself, and her head sagged, for she could not be sure that Somerset was alive. All she knew for certain was that in the final days of Vicksburg, a Yankee shell had ripped off his left arm. At first he had been reported dead from loss of blood, but then soldiers from his unit, now in prison camp in Mississippi, had sent word that Major Cobb, not the red-headed one, had been taken in by two elderly women in the town and nursed. "And you can thank God for that," a fellow officer wrote, "because if he had fallen into one of our hospitals or into a Yankee prison camp, he'd be dead." Perhaps he was dead. Perhaps her son Reverdy was dead, too. Perhaps the Yankees would invade Texas and set the plantations aflame, as they were doing in other parts of the Confederacy. The possibilities for disaster were so overwhelming that she could not face them, and her health, never good, began to deteriorate badly. As the heat of summer increased, she found difficulty in breathing, and on one extremely hot afternoon, she felt she must apologize to her energetic cousin. "Petty Prue, I am not malingering. I want to help, but I'm truly sick, and I'm frightened." "Stay in bed, Lissa. I'll manage." Prue could not have done it alone, but like many women all over Texas who had to manage large holdings while their men were absent, she learned that she could rely on her slaves, especially Jaxifer from Georgia and Trajan from Edisto. With no white master to berate him and sometimes beat him, Jaxifer assumed a more important role, issuing orders to other slaves and seeing that they were carried out. It was he who kept a small herd of cattle hidden in the breaks, away from government agents who would have impressed them for military use. Occasionally, he would butcher one of the precious steers in the dark of night, and mysteriously appear in the morning with small portions of beef for all. We got meat. Trajan was even more ingenious. He found the honey trees, which provided a substitute for sugar. He tracked down a bear now and then, knowing that, when smoked, this made bacon almost as tasty as a hog's. But when he first placed it on the table, Millicent whispered, "One can hardly eat this without salt." Trajan heard, and although store salt was absolutely unobtainable, he had the clever idea of digging up the soil where meat had been cured in peacetime and boiling it until salt could be skimmed off. It was dirty, but it was good. His major contribution to Petit Prou was the substitute he devised for coffee. Now, this here is parched corn, and this is charred okra. You mix them just right, you got... It tastes... well... well, it ain't coffee, and it don't taste like coffee, but it looks like it. Often, during that dreadful July, Petit Prou wondered why her slaves did not run away, for with no master to check them, they could have. But they stayed without restraint to keep the two plantations running. It's because, Prue explained to her neighbors, they're happy here. They like being slaves when the master is kind. In whispers, when she attended church on Sunday, she asked the older people, "Do you think the slaves know what Mr. Lincoln's done?" The white folk were aware that on the first day of January, 1863, he had tried to put into effect his Emancipation Proclamation, freeing slaves. And by the most rigid controls, the whites in remote areas like Jefferson prevented this news from reaching their slaves, so that men like Jaxifer and Trajan worked on, legally free, but actually still slaves. "Tell them nothing," Petit Prou warned Millicent and the two Cobb daughters. And when an elderly white man from the village came to visit and refresh himself with the good food raised at Lammermoor, he gave them reason to keep silent. "Emancipation Proclamation, rubbish. The most cynical thing that evil man in the White House ever did." "Someday the slaves will have to be freed," Millicent protested. "Many would agree with you," the old man said. "Economically?" He shrugged his shoulders. "That young fellow who stayed with you, Carmody, who wrote the book about us, he made some points, but the slaves will never be freed the way Lincoln said." "What did the gangling fool say?" Petit Prou asked, for she was willing to believe anything bad about Lincoln, author of so many tragedies. "It isn't what he said, it's what he didn't say. Tell me, please." "Duplicity, total duplicity. He has freed the slaves in all those parts of the former Union over which he now has no control, and he has not freed them in the areas which he does control." "I can't believe it," Prue snapped. "You better. Your slaves here in Texas, where his words don't mean a damn, thank God, are freed. So are they in Carolina and Georgia and the rest of the Confederacy. But in Maryland and Kentucky and Tennessee, and even in Louisiana, where the Federals control, they are not freed, because good, honest Abe does not want to irritate his northern allies, God damn their souls." The four Cobb women had a difficult time digesting this immoral northern charade, but the old man made it simple. Where he can, he won't, and where he can't, he does. Some patriot with good sense ought to shoot him. The owners of plantations had extra reason for caution, because once the slaves learned that they were free, they would surely desert, and the cotton would rot in the fields. But by extreme caution, they continued to keep news of emancipation, fraudulent though it might be, from their slaves, and it was well known that anyone who divulged the information, or even hinted at it, would be hanged. But now the problem arose as to what to do with this new crop of cotton, which could no longer be sent to New Orleans. And Petit Prou, as the one who had to make decisions, pondered this for a long time. And the same old man, a furious patriot, came out from Jefferson to counsel with her. "If I was younger, ma'am, you can be sure I'd be trying to sneak this cotton through the blockade to Liverpool. But I'm not young any more, and no woman by herself could do it." "What can I do?" "Keep your voice down," the old man said conspiratorily as he led her to the gin. "But this cotton is the lifeblood of the Confederacy. We have no manufacturing, as your book-writing fellow said, and we have few railroads. But by God, we have cotton, and the world needs it." Picking at the edge of a bale, he fingered the precious fiber he had spent his life producing. "On this wharf, it's worth 1¾ cents a pound. Aboard ship to Europe, it's worth $1.60 a pound. With Vicksburg gone and Lee thrown back at Gettysburg, we must get it on board some ship somehow." "I'll try anything," Prue said. The old man looked at the bayou to which boats ought to have been coming, and tears showed in his eyes. By water, no hope. Even if you could get it overland to Galveston, the Yankees would still intercept it when you tried to ship. Then his eyes brightened with the thrill of old challenges. "But, ma'am, if you could somehow work your bales far inland, and then drop down to the safety of Matamoros in old Mexico, you'd have a market as big as the world." "I do not understand," Prue said. And the old man explained. "Abe Lincoln's warships keep us bottled up everywhere. Oh, a few blockade runners slip in and out of the Atlantic ports, but not many. They've tied up Texas, too. For a while, Brownsville was kept open, but Abe corked that real quick. So what does that leave us? Matamoros, just over the Rio Grande from Brownsville." When he told her that sometimes as many as 100 ships lay off Matamoros hungry for cotton, she asked, "Why doesn't Lincoln sink them?" And he cried, "That's the arrow that we have in our quiver. What one thing could win the war for us tomorrow?" When she said she didn't know, he explained, "If England and France jump in on our side to ensure safe delivery of cotton, Lincoln doesn't dare antagonize Europe, so he's got to let English and French ships come to Matamoros and load up." Pettigrew walked up and down her wharf, studied the accumulating bales, then snapped her fingers. "I'm taking ours to Matamoros." Once the decision was made, she never looked back. With an energy that would have alarmed her husband, who had known her as a little wren of a woman, she worked almost without sleeping, and her enthusiasm ignited the imaginations of her slaves. "There are two ways we can go," she said at the beginning of the discussions with Jaxifer and Trajan. "We can cut west to Waco, where they're assembling shipments, and sell to the government, lose half our profit. Or we can drop in a straight line down to Matamoros and sell our bales for maybe 80 cents a pound." The two men listened. Then Jaxifer asked, "You going with us?" "It's my cotton, my responsibility." A plan was devised whereby four extra stout carts would be loaded, each with 5 bales of 500 pounds each. If they could deliver the cotton to the Mexican side, it would bring $8,000, a gamble worth taking. But one night, as she concluded the final plans for the bold journey, she had a frightening doubt. In ordering her carriage to be readied, she had Jaxifer drive her to Jefferson, where she asked the old man one question. "When we get to the Rio Grande, how do we get the bales across to Mexico?" And he said, "If cotton is so valuable, they'll work out a way." "But they say there's no bridge. No ferry could handle all the bales you speak of." "If the world needs cotton, they'll find a way." "I'll risk it, then." The old man grasped Prue's hands. "I wish I had a daughter like you." But this farewell was dampened by the agitated arrival of a horseman from Lammermoor. "Missy, hurry! Miss Lissa, she's sick bad." The old man insisted upon accompanying Prue to the plantations, and when they reached the kitchen at Lammermoor, they found that Millicent had been working there with the slaves, making jelly and preserving fruit, in the last moments before she died. Prue, looking at the scene she had shared so often with her cousin, did not weep or cry out. Slowly, she slipped to the polished floor, and there she stared at the uneven patterns. For life had become too complex for her to unravel. The old man proved to be most valuable, not because of anything he did, for he was frail and nearing his own death, but because of the sensible advice he gave and his shrewd analysis of alternatives. "Of course you could go with your cotton, Miss Prue, but what happens to the plantations if you do? What makes you think Somerset will ever return if his wound was as bad as they say? With you gone, Jaxifer gone, Trajan gone, crows will tend cotton on this farm." Patiently, he led her to the only sensible conclusion. "Would to God I could volunteer to manage your place while you go, but I'm too old." He fought back tears. "I won't live to see the end of this war. If I did take charge and died while you were gone, chaos, chaos. What must I do? You have two treasures, these valuable bales, these valuable plantations. Surely the second is more important than the first." "But I'm going to protect both," she said stubbornly. "The only way, send your cotton south with Trajan and Jaxifer." "Can I trust them?" "What choice have you? You've got to stay here with that trustworthy slave, Big Matthew, and pray for the best." Again, once the decision was reached, she did not flinch. Inspecting the four wagons, she was satisfied from what Jaxifer told her that they would withstand the load and the 600-mile trip. She watched as the men loaded each wagon, three bales crossways on the bottom, two perched on top, and satisfied herself that each wagon carried heavy grease for the axles. And when all was ready, she asked the old man to deliver to each of the four slaves who would be driving the wagons a copy of a letter he had had the local judge prepare. Jefferson, Marion County, Texas, 21 July, 1863. To whom it may concern. This will certify that the bearer of this note, the slave known as Trajan, is on official duty for the Confederate government, delivering cotton to Matamoros in Mexico and returning home to his plantation as above. The government will appreciate any consideration and protection you may give him while he is discharging this important assignment. Henry Applewhite, Judge of the County Court. To travel 600 miles to the Rio Grande with the heavily laden wagons was a journey of at least 2 months, for rivers had to be forded and forests negotiated. Also, the route had to be painstakingly deciphered, with rascals on every hand to belay and betray, especially when the men in charge were slaves. But Trajan was resourceful, 47 years old, and afraid of very little, and with Jaxifer's help he proposed to deliver this cotton to Mexico and earn his mistress a fine penny for doing it. They had been on the trail about a week when Trajan saw, joining them from the west, a remarkable sight. Two wagons, well loaded with bales, but without drivers. "What can this be?" he asked his fellow drivers in Gullah, and they could not guess, so he left his own wagons and started walking toward the mystery. But as he drew close, he heard a child's voice crying, "Don't you come no closer!" And when he looked up, he found himself facing a very big gun in the possession of a very small boy. On the second wagon, with his own gun properly pointed, sat an even smaller boy. "What you doin'?" Trajan asked, indicating that the boys should put up their guns. "One more step," the first boy warned, and Trajan realized that he meant it, so he stopped, held out his empty hands, and asked, "What you doin', boys?" And after a pause in which the first boy looked back to the second, they confessed that they were taking their family's cotton to Galveston. "Where's your father?" "Dead, at Vicksburg." "You got no uncles?" "They're at war." "Your mother?" "She's working the farm." "Galveston is not the best." "Don't you take a step. They told me people would try." And then Trajan saw that the two boys were near to exhaustion, for the one in back had begun to cry, at which his older brother shouted, "Stop that, damn it! We're being held up." But the younger boy could not stop. These days had been too long and cruel. And now to be accosted by a bunch of slaves who intended cutting throats. "I want to go home." "Course you do. So do I." And something in the way Trajan spoke softened the heart of the boy in front, and now he, too, began to cry. "Now you hold on to your guns, boys, but you got to get some rest." And hardly had he led the two wagons to his fore than the two young fellows were sound asleep. Trajan lifted them onto his wagon, and as they slept, the most powerful and confusing emotions swept over him. For the boys were about the age his son had been when he was stolen. Endlessly he had brooded about his lost son, wondering where Hadrian could be. And now he asked himself, was he as brave as these two youngsters were in defending their bales of cotton? When the boys at last awakened, aware that they were at the mercy of the strange Negroes, Trajan did his best to comfort them. But whenever he tried to explain why they must not go to Galveston, where the Federal ships prowled trying to steal Confederate cotton, they suspected trickery. So always the slave said, "All right, all right. We'll go as far as we can together. Then you hie off for Galveston and the enemy." The oldest boy, Michael, was 11, and old enough to think that there might be something most suspicious about Trajan and his three companions, especially Jaxifer, who looked very black and ferocious. Trajan himself had no clearer view of things, for he knew that in delivering cotton to Matamoros he was aiding the Confederacy, which was determined to keep him a slave forever. And therefore what he was doing was stupid. But he also knew that through the years he had lived in moderate decency with the Cobbs of Edisto, and that they had not changed for the worse in moving to Texas. He suspected that within his lifetime all slaves would be set free, for he had heard through rumors and the surreptitious teaching of Methodist ministers that there were large parts of the nation where blacks were free, and where food and clothing and medicine were just about as available as in Texas. He had known perhaps a dozen slaves who had tried to escape to Mexico. Most had been recaptured quickly with the aid of tracking dogs. Others had returned of their own will, unable to cross the great expanse that seemed to encircle the little green paradise of Jefferson. And he had seen both groups savagely whipped for their attempt to escape bondage. But he also knew that a handful had either made it to freedom in Mexico or died in the attempt. He had never felt impelled to run away from the Cobbs, for they were about as decent as the system provided, despite Reuben's hot temper at times. But he did know that if the new masters who might be taking over at Lammermoor proved brutal, he would flee. Why, then, did not he and the other three plan at that moment to get as close to Mexico as practical, take the money for cotton, and run for freedom? They were restrained because all they knew, all they loved, centered on Lammermoor. In Trajan's case, there was another factor. He had been given a responsibility, and as a man of honor, he must discharge it. He was considering these conflicts, answers to which could determine his chance for freedom, when he was faced by a more immediate problem. "We want to go to Galveston," Michael said one morning, as he and his brother faced the four slaves. "We think you're kidnapping us and stealing our cotton, and we want our guns back." "You have them," Trajan said. "You've always had them." "Then can we go to Galveston?" "You're going to Galveston. That's always been understood." "Where is it?" Now Trajan asked the boys to sit with him, and as they perched beside the road, he had to confess, "I don't know where it is, but the first person we meet on this road, we're going to ask." The boys could not believe that Trajan was telling the truth, and they wanted desperately to draw apart and discuss the trap into which they had fallen with their mother's cotton. But they were afraid to do so, lest the slaves kill them right there. So they were overjoyed when they saw coming at them from the south a group of riders, and they were especially relieved to see that they were white. But when the riders reined in at the lead wagon, they were far less pleased, for the leader was a terrifying man, very tall, covered with hair, dirty, mean-looking, and topped by a panther pelt which he wore with the tail hanging down the left side of his face. Sergeant Comex, Confederate Army, on duty with these men to gather all cotton wagons headed for Matamoros and bring them in safely. "Which way is Galveston?" Michael asked very politely. "Don't matter. Everybody goes to Matamoros. You niggers, what you doing?" Very carefully, very politely, Trajan directed Jaxifer to show the paper which the judge had written. He certainly did not propose to show his copy, lest the soldiers keep it. When Comex had one of his men read the safe passage to him, he grunted. "We find a lot of slaves taking their plantation cotton south. Join up." Comex had little trouble convincing Trajan to agree, but when he turned to the two boys, he found himself looking into the same cumbersome rifles that had stopped the slave. "We're going to Galveston," Michael said in his quavering voice. And he was supported by his brother, who cried, "You come closer, we shoot." To Trajan's surprise, the big, hairy man halted immediately and withdrew. "Do something with them kids. You act as if they's gonna shoot. At their age, I'd have shot." So once more, Trajan had to convince his two charges that going to Galveston was not only impractical, but also forbidden. With the gravest foreboding that they might be slain or their cotton taken from them, the boys lowered their guns. But during the rest of this dangerous journey, they remained close to Trajan, for Panther Comex terrified them. By the end of that week, three other wagons had fallen in line, and during the week after, four more. The plodding caravan had now passed Victoria and was about to skirt the dangerous port city of Corpus Christi, blockaded by Union ships. By the time Comex was ready to ford the shallow Nueces River, other Confederate scouts had rounded up a dozen or more creaking wagons, and Panther gave stern orders. "Yonder, the Nueces Strip. We keep together for three reasons. Benito Garza and his bandits might attack, Union troops coming at us from the sea might attack, and if you fall behind, you will perish for lack of water. Get." It was about 140 miles, in the hottest time of the year. The draft animals sometimes staggered in the blazing heat, and men fared little better, so that even the slaves, who were supposed to be impervious to heat, sweated and groaned. At times there seemed to be not a single living thing on the vast coastal plains, so flat they were, so devoid of pleasant vales and cool streamlets. The drivers wrapped rags across their faces and looked like ghosts gray with dust. But still, the dreadful heat assailed them. Water was rationed, and at the worst of the journey, exhausted men and animals simply lay on the ground during the sunlight hours, sweating and jabbing at insects. There was no shade except under the wagons. It seemed stupid to be lying bathed in sweat, but the brief rest enabled the teams to travel through the cooler night. And then the miracle of Texas happened, because wherever in this vast state one traveled, arid and forbidding land finally ended and green pastures appeared. Comex had brought his caravan safely into the valley of the Rio Grande, that fragile paradise where a few industrious farmers were beginning to coax the waters of the river inland to produce the finest fruits and dairy cattle in this part of the world. Rarely were travelers more delighted to find shade and cool water. At Brownsville, the difficulty that Petty Prue had foreseen eventuated. Overland convoys, like the one Panther Comex had brought through safely, were arriving constantly. And with only one small, overworked ferry available for carrying the bales across the Rio Grande, a swirling confusion developed. Men with the loudest voices and the roughest manners preempted the ferry. And even though Panther was strong in both departments, he had learned that he had little chance of forcing the cotton of these slaves and their two small boys onto that precious craft. "Why wait?" he said to Trajan. "You can swim it across." "Me?" "Yes," Panther explained. "You lug them bales to that river's edge, and then you shoves them in, and you follow. And you kick your feet like a puppy dog, and pretty soon you're on the other side." Not me. If you don't do it, it ain't gonna get done. He showed the slaves how to muscle the bales right down to the river, and then he demonstrated how Trajan must jump in after the bale and push it to the far side. But Trajan was terrified. Cotton don't float, and Lord knows I don't float. But it does float. Enough air locked in there makes it a boat. Water hit cotton, it's ruined. It's packed so tight, water don't penetrate quarter of an inch. Carefully, Panther explained that perfect safety prevailed. Cotton floats, you float. Nothing gets wet but your black hide. You ride back on the empty ferry. If Trajan was scared of the water, Jaxifer and the other two were paralyzed, and there seemed no way that the cob bales were going to be delivered to the people on the south shore who were eager to pay a fortune to get them. So, cursing all black men in words which ought to have shriveled Trajan's skin, but which affected him not at all, for he was not going into that river, Panther shed most of his clothes until he stood a forbidding hairy ape at the side of the Rio Grande. Instructing the slaves how to get the heavy bale into the water, he swore and plunged in after it. But he had taken only the first few kicks when off to his right he heard a boyish shout. It's easy. And Michael was steering across the first of the many bales he would manage that day. Swearing a new set of oaths, Comax crawled out of the water, grabbed Trajan by the neck, and thundered, If he can do it, you can. And Trajan, trembling like an aspen, edged into the water, kicked, and found that it would require 50 strong men to sink that bale of air-filled cotton. On the next trip, even the smaller boy, Clem, swam his bale across. But no one, not even Comax with all his profanity, could get Jaxifer and the other slaves into that river. Returning on the ferry after each trip, Trajan and the boys got their entire cargo across. And then the slave offered the lads a proposition. Clem, you the littlest, you swim over to the other shore and mind our cotton. Jaxifer, you stay here. Michael, you and me is gonna earn a fortune. And they did. Well practiced now in swimming, they invited cautious owners to shove their bales into the water where they took charge, maneuvering them to the Mexican shore. They charged for this service, and so jammed were the supply lines that after several dripping days they had accumulated quite a few dollars and would have been willing to continue the traffic indefinitely, for, as Michael said, after you've been without water in the strip, this is fun. But now problems of a much different nature confronted them, because they must arrange a deal for their cotton and see that it reached some waiting cargo ship off the Mexican shore. And this threw them into the tremendous chaos of Matamoros, which stood 27 miles inland from the Gulf. More than 60 small sailing craft crowded the river, clinging meticulously to the Mexican half, with each owner screaming, I'll carry your bales out to the big ships waiting in the Gulf. And if one did elect one of these boats, greater confusion followed. For when the open sea was reached, the pilot must turn immediately south and take refuge in Mexican waters, where 200 ships from all the ports of Europe posted seamen on their decks who bellowed, We'll take your cotton to Liverpool. Off to the north, sometimes less than 100 yards away, hovered warships of the United States Navy, never leaving American waters, but always ready to pounce upon any ship laden with cotton that moved even a foot north of the international line. Day after painful day, the comedy was played out. Cargo ships, owned by supposedly loyal northern merchants in New York, sailed blithely to some British or French port, or to any neutral port, where they were instantly issued papers by European powers, hungry for cotton. Then, as privileged ships of that nation, they sailed to join the fleet waiting at Matamoros, hoping to acquire a load of cotton. In exchange, they would give the Confederates shot and shell, muskets and hardware, cloth and food. If the Confederate government could move its cotton onto a European ship, it could acquire in exchange almost anything it needed. But how, in this welter of thievery, chicanery, and murder, could a slave like Trajan, or two boys like Michael and Clem hoped to get their bales from Matamoros to the waiting fleet. There was a way. The Confederate government had assigned a clever, manipulative man to Matamoros, and his job was to collect the cotton ferried or swum across the river and move it overland to the improvised Mexican seaport of Baghdad, a line of shacks along an open beach, and there turn it over to an even more ingenious Mexican conniver who saw to it that the bales got aboard ship. The Confederate was big, jovial Yancey Quimper, dressed in full uniform, ideally qualified as an expediter, and willing to pay any graft to accomplish his ends. The Mexican was a dapper man in a bright red uniform laden with medals, known as El Capitan. The two connivers were well matched, with Quimper's military rank as spurious as El Capitan's medals, and together they controlled the movement of cotton to the world markets. The finances of this sleazy operation were interesting. Cost of growing, 7 cents a pound. Value on an interior Texas plantation, 1¾ cents. Value delivered on the north bank of the Rio Grande, 22 cents. On the south bank, 37 cents. Delivered by General Quimper to Baghdad, 49 cents, of which he pocketed 6 cents. Delivered to a waiting ship by El Capitan, 89 cents, of which he pocketed 7 cents. Placed on the dock at Liverpool, $1.60, of which the shipowner retained a large portion. Since thousands of pounds were being moved daily, it was obvious that the two expediters were getting rich. But so were many other patriots who managed to escape battle. There could have been unpleasantness over the fact that the captain was stealing a penny more per pound than the general, but Quimper also had a neat plan working whereby he bought for his own account, and not the government's, 5 or 6 bales each day if he could force some unfortunate seller to unload them at bottom price. These bales he disposed of through a special, undocumented arrangement with a Russian ship captain. One praised a man like Major Reuben Cobb for being loyal to his theory of honor, or Sam Houston for being loyal to his theory of government. But it was also possible for a man to be loyal only to himself, and to adjust quickly to every whimsical gale which affected his interests. Yancey Quimper saw in the Union effort to strangle the Confederacy a chance to make his fortune. Every situation in which decent men exalt noble sentiments is used as a chance to profit by those who look at such sentiments cynically. One Confederate soldier, assigned to help Quimper in his work, a veteran who had fought at Shiloh, summarized it well. "This is a rich man's war, a poor man's battle." Quimper, evaluating the same evidence, said, "When bugles blow, wise men know." How had this man of no character and limited talent found himself in so many theaters of the war? At the Kansas preliminaries, at the massacre of the Germans, in charge of the hangings along the Red River, and now supervising operations in the cotton exchange, not to mention months spent tracking down draft evaders hiding in the big thicket northeast of Houston. 2 reasons. The war was appallingly prolonged, with the nation's best men dying year after hideous year. And this provided time for those left at home to pursue many activities. Indeed, a man like Quimper was forced into them. He was in Brownsville because the Confederacy needed him there. Also, when good men like Somerset Cobb and Otto McNabb were engaged in battle, only the dregs were left to manage scandalous operations like those along the Rio Grande. It was highly improbable that naive cotton handlers like Trajan and Michael could bring their bales into Quimper's maelstrom and end up with any money at all. But they had one advantage. Panther Comex had grown to love Texas, and this meant that he hated Abe Lincoln and the North. And if he had brought his convoy so far, he was determined to see that his bales at least reached their proper destination. More important in the present situation, he had once watched helplessly as Yancey Quimper stole his bootmaker, Juan Hernandez. So, When he overheard the general trying to pluck off the cotton of his charges, he suddenly leaped from behind a stack of bales, gun drawn, and shouting, "Quimper, you'll take these bales to your Russian captain, and you'll pay nobody, not even yourself." Terrified and sweating, with the gun at his belly, Quimper took the boys and their cotton out to Baghdad, waved away El Capitan with the warning, "This is special," and concluded a deal which gave the amateurs an honest profit. And Comax and the boys watched from the beach as the Russian ship raised sail and started for Europe. In Brownsville, Comax arranged for their funds to be transferred by a letter of credit on an English bank, so they don't steal them from you on the way home. The boys did not trust this, fearing that Panther would cheat them the way General Quimper had tried to. But Trajan, who had seen letters of credit at the mill, although he could not read them, assured the boys that Comax was telling the truth. "The money be waiting for you when you gets home. Gemmans do business this way." But now he had his own problem. From his tireless work swimming the bales across the Rio Grande, he had accumulated more than $100, and he knew that if he appeared at the plantation with such funds, he would be accused of having stolen them. So he asked Comax if he, Panther, would write him out a statement explaining that the money really was his. "I can't write," Panther said, but he found one of his men who could, and the precious document was executed. Brownsville, Texas, 9 November 1863, to whom it concerns. This certificate proves the slave known as Trajan earned $139.40 by swimming cotton across the Rio Grande. The money is his, dutifully earned, and I swear to, said. Johnson Carver, Confederate Army. Trajan had been so preoccupied with financial arrangements for himself and the boys that he failed to notice a development in his group. Now Jaxifer came to him, no longer the noisy young clown whom Trajan had met on the approach to social circle, but a powerful man, mature and thoughtful. Micah, he done gone. And Trajan realized that Micah had found the temptation of freedom in Mexico too powerful to resist, and was no doubt already in Monterrey. This presented difficult choices for the three remaining Lammermoor slaves, who discussed them using the deepest gullah. When such slaves used their fragmentary English, they came up with constructions which sounded funny, like, "he done gone." But when they spoke in gullah, they had a complete language for the expression of complete thoughts, and there was nothing amusing about it. "Why should we three go back to slavery?" Jaxifer asked. "Micah did no wrong," Trajan replied evasively. "If he felt he had to be free, how about us?" "There Mexico is, spit across the river. You'll never be closer." "If I go, will you try to stop me?" Jaxifer asked, for it was obvious that the third slave, Oliver, would not make the attempt. Trajan pondered Jaxifer's question a long time, for it cut to the heart of black-white relations, and also to the core of his own behavior. A man wants to be free, that's maybe the biggest thing in life. If you feel it in your heart, Jaxifer, go. How about you? Well now, no man wants freedom more than I do. I lost my son because people knew they could steal from a slave no trouble. I lost my wife, worked to death. Then join me. No, I want to be free more than any of you. But freedom is surely coming in Texas. He hesitated before making a point which for him weighed most heavily. Better to work hard for freedom in a good place like Texas than accept it easy in a place not so good like Mexico. Before Jaxifer could respond, he added, "At night I say to myself, Trajan, you built Lammermoor as much as any Cobbs. It's your place too. I do not want to give up a place I built." "But up there you'll always be a slave." "Not always." "Do you believe that?" "If I didn't, I would cut my throat." Jaxifer asked, "If I cross the river, will you send soldiers after me?" Oh, Jaxifer, how can you ask?
Then why don't you come with me?
Again Trajan thought a long time before answering. I promised Miss Prue and the old man I'd get the cotton south, I'd collect the money, and I'd bring it home.
But it went home by the bank, you said so.
The money's home, yes, but now I have to go. Jefferson is where I belong. At the edge of the Rio Grande, Jaxifer stared in silence at his longtime friends, Trajan and Oliver. Then, turning his back upon them, he strode to where bales waited and pushed one into the river. Terrified though he was, he plunged in, grasping a corner of the bale with both arms and kicking his feet frantically as the cotton carried him to freedom.